Okay, we're now recording, and I'll get a light on so that it doesn't look so foggy. Yeah, I see Ross here.
There we go. Good morning, Hugh.
Good morning. I just got you promoted.
Thank you. Hi, Mark.
Okay.
Well, you still got that great building I built for you there in the background, huh?
You know, every time I use it, I think of you.
When are we going to do another one?
Probably in a couple of weeks. You know, I should have another couple of million in the bank and be able to fund it.
I can whip it out in about 3 or 4 days. So whenever.
I know you can. That's why I use you.
Good. Mark, I got a question for you. I was talking to Travis Campbell this week, and he asked if I could do a plug for his book, and I wanted to check with you if that was okay.
Yeah, he's one of the apologist community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, good. Good. And I got a book. I want to recommend that Nancy Piercy book that I've been working on, too. What association does she have with you and RTB, Hugh, Nancy Piercy?
She doesn't have any association. She is associated with a Discovery. No, I think she's on her own now. She was associated with a Discovery Institute.
Uh-huh.
I think she took up a professorship in a school of apologetics at maybe Houston Baptist, but I'm not positive.
Okay.
So I'm not sure where she is exactly right now.
I'm really impressed with her latest book. It's called Finding Truth.
She's sticking to her bailiwick, which I think is good.
Yeah.
Some of her previous books, she was overreaching a bit on the science.
Okay.
But I think that this is more in line with what her education and skill set is.
Yeah, she provides a structure that I find really useful for, you know, everything we learn about theology, the Bible, apologetics can fit into this structure when you're using it to witness. And I just think it's really well done.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So are we doing any breakouts today, Hugh, or are we doing a...
I got a setup for the next 6 weeks. And it'll be the same URL as we used this week. And last week, I let it run from noon to 12:30.
Okay.
And at least the group I was in, people seemed to enjoy the discussion. And in fact, I'm going to leave off with a discussion question for the group when we hit noon.
Oh, good. Okay.
I think it's just fun for people to get to know one another. I mean, I was thrilled just to hear the testimonies of the different class members.
Oh, good. Yeah, I wish there was a schmooze button on Zoom and we could all just hang out afterwards. And
well, that's coming, but the software is not here yet.
Yeah.
But that's why I have to terminate the webinar and start the meeting.
Yeah, yeah.
But eventually we're going to be able to make a seamless switch.
That would be good.
Yeah. But a lot of people told me they really want to have some sense of virtual fellowship. And with a webinar, that's simply not possible.
Right.
So that's why I got the meeting thing set up. It'll be interesting to hear people's feedback, just whether or not they're appreciating it.
Yeah.
But having it at the very end, I think, is the easiest way to make it work.
Okay, well, good. Well, I'll let you lead on that, of course.
Okay.
Whatever you want to do. I was on the, I guess Fuzz Rana had a, on Thursday, he did a little thing for Apologist. I was on there and he was talking about the new book that's coming out on evolution. That sounds really good.
Yeah, I think it's going to be released like in October. So.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
25 questions about evolution? I don't remember what the title is, but that's the...
Yeah, it's 25 chapters, and then there's a bonus chapter.
Yeah. Because
the book came in too long, so we recreated an online bonus chapter. And I'm worried that might have to happen with my next book, too, because my word count's starting to get up there.
He said all the chapters were really good, except the one that Mark wrote.
Oh, really?
No. Yeah, he recommended it. He said it's really, really good. I'm looking forward to it. What was your chapter on, Mark?
You're muted?
You're muted.
I knew that. I was just testing you.
Oh, okay. I'm right there.
Yeah, good for you. My chapter was on the fallacies of evolution and then fallacies in general. It's a very small chapter. It really doesn't have a lot to it. But the point of the chapter was to get people to understand that when you have all of these different questions floating around in the environment on evolution, that there are certain things you have to pay attention to, regardless of what side you're on. Because one of the emphases I made in that chapter is that, you know, just because you're a Christian doesn't mean you're immune to fallacies.
Right.
So the point was to help people think through these problems, because some of the stuff that the other authors were getting into involved things like, what counts as science, and what is a scientific statement, and so forth. So those kinds of things I talked about, and so that chapter was specifically about how to think about it. The other chapters were content on the scientific aspects.
Okay. Mark, I know you're reading that book, Deniable Darwin by Berlinski. Can you recommend that book?
Well, it's a collection of articles. I would say yes, as a, if you want to get into some pretty dense stuff. Berlinski's really good.
Yeah.
Very thoughtful. But some of the stuff is almost like it's poetry, and it's not rhyming or anything like that. It's just beautiful writing.
Artistically done. He's a great writer. I've read him before.
Yeah.
Well, guys, it's 10:30, so maybe we ought to launch.
Okay. All right. Hang on just a second there.
Sure.
All right, so do we have any questions left over from last week? Let's see. Yeah, Hugh, we've got a question from Yuvin.
Okay.
LA area. He says, looking forward to today's class. Dr. Ross, can we use the book of Proverbs as a means of promise for us? Much wisdom is found in this book, but some preachers have warned us that this book can't be literally taken as a promise or blessing. For example, Proverbs 10:27, fear of the Lord prolongs life.
Yeah. Yeah, you need to understand the context of each proverb. And that one's basically saying that, you know, if you practice the fear of the Lord, it's going to extend your lifespan. So I think that we can count on, that the average lifespan for people who fear the Lord will be longer. I mean, one statistic I can share with you is that, you know, Christians who attend church on a weekly basis tend to live about 8 years longer than the rest of the population. So there is a benefit to fearing the Lord. But yeah, it's not a guarantee that you, Mark, are going to live to be 98 just because you attend church every week, you read the Bible, and you fear the Lord. What it's basically saying is, it will extend your lifespan beyond what would happen if you don't fear the Lord.
Good. Well, thank you. Hugh, are we recording? Are we on record?
We're on recording.
Excellent.
And we got quite a few participants or attendees, so they may have some questions too.
Good. All right. Well, Chris Thompson in Anchorage says, various understandings on biblical inerrancy. Would you please articulate your understanding?
Yeah, there are many different definitions of biblical inerrancy that are floating around the Christian community. The one that we adhere to at Reasons to Believe are the affirmations and denials that have been written down by the International Council on Biblical Inerrancy. I mean, this was a group of over 300 theologians from around the world who got together and spent 10 years defining what biblical inerrancy is and what it is not. And so they were very careful not to come across as saying we interpret every passage of the Bible in a wooden, literal way. I mean, if you did that, then you'd be questioning the verse in John 10 where Jesus says, "I am the door." And you say, well, he's not a piece of wood, so that means the Bible made a mistake here, rather than recognizing that Jesus was referring to the door as a metaphor, a doorway. So they're very good at clarifying that. And then you can go to Dallas Theological Seminary's website. They archive there, free for everybody, not only all the affirmations and denials. And by the way, there's two sets. There's one set on biblical inerrancy, and there's another set on hermeneutics, how we're to interpret the Bible. And the affirmations and denials on hermeneutics are the best for defining what biblical inerrancy is, at least from the perspective of the ICBI. And then accompanying that are over 2,000 pages of commentary, because what they did over that 10-year period is they broke up that group about 300 theologians. And by the way, they also involved a few scientists. They invited them in on issues that pertain to science and the Bible. And so there would be about a group of 30 each who would look at a very small subset of inerrancy. For example, how do we look at biblical inerrancy in the context of what the Bible says about marriage and divorce? They had another one on family, one on finances, so they broke it down into groups. From our perspective at Reasons to Believe, probably the most valuable one was a group that studied Genesis and creation. And they wound up producing some statements. And then, you know, they would basically dialogue long enough where they would get everybody to say, okay, we can all sign this. This is something we would all agree to adhere to. And I heard that that worked out well for all but two of the topics that were discussed. One was on divorce and remarriage, where they had a split vote. And the other one where they had a split vote was on Genesis and creation. In that case, 29 of the participants signed and one did not. Hmm. And the one that did not was Henry Morse of the Institute of Creation Research. But the other 29 all signed it. All the theologians signed it.
Thank you, Hugh. We have a question from Stephen Posta in Spring, Texas. He says, last week you said you were anxiously awaiting our return to the moon in order to determine more closely when the oxygenation events occurred on the Earth. Please explain why we can't get that same information from directly studying the Earth.
Well, we can get some of that information for studying the Earth. If you look at the graph that I put in Improbable Planet, it basically shows the oxygen history of Earth's atmosphere from what we understand from measurements on the Earth. And you notice we do have reasonably good data, except for about a little more than a billion long period. It's called the Boring Billion. And it's not a boring era in Earth's history, but it is an era where it's difficult to come up with high quality data. So if you look at that graph, I have a dotted line there. And, you know, there's good reasons why we can think that the oxygen content in Earth's atmosphere during that billion plus years was less than 1%, almost certainly less than 2%. But it's dotted because we really don't know for certain. Whereas if we go to the moon, where the moon has not had any geological disturbances throughout that boring billion, we're going to actually be able to get high quality data. And I think we're also going to get higher quality data for the rest of the oxygen history in Earth's atmosphere. Because what affects the isotope measurements on Earth are geological activity. And so that boring billion is a period where we not only don't have good oxygen data, there's a lot of other data we don't have that we'd like to have. And as I mentioned last week, the moon is like an attic. I mean, an attic is a place where you put your stuff, knowing that it's going to be stable. It's not going to get moved around. You go up there and you can find it. And that's the advantage of our moon, is that it's a very stable place. It has almost no geological activity. So anything from planet Earth that got deposited there by a meteoroid impacts of the Earth will be there in pristine form. Whereas that's not going to be case on the Earth, because geological activity has disturbed the evidence. But we can go to the moon and find us. That gives us a second reason for going back to the moon. And incidentally, I got a lot of posts on my Facebook page and Twitter page about that during the past week. And they're saying, you know, is there any way we can get all that data without sending people? And I know a lot of people like to go there and get that data. But the answer is, today we've got the technology where there's no need whatsoever to send human beings a spaceship to the moon. We can recover all the data we need just by sending machines. A lot cheaper, more reliable actually, and certainly safer. We don't have to worry about trying to keep astronauts alive and keep them healthy. We just send the machines.
Thank you, Hugh. Our friend Doug McComb here in Monrovia has two related questions. He says, what does space dust consist of and how do we know?
Well, the universe is filled with gas and dust. It's very almost vacuous. I mean, you're looking at about, you know, if you go into interstellar space, it's about one particle per cubic meter. So it is a very close to a perfect vacuum. You look in the disk of our galaxy, it is filled with dust. And that dust is most dense in the plane of our galaxy. And we're orbiting close to the plane right now. So the dust is there. And we can determine what that dust is through spectroscopy, using our telescopes and looking at the spectral signature of that dust. And so we can get a good idea of what it is made of. And it's similar to the dust that's in our planetary system. Although one thing we do know is the dust that's in interplanetary space has a much heavier ratio of heavy elements than what we see in interstellar space. And likewise, we do see that there's a difference in the heavy element abundance at different galactic, different distances from the center of our galaxy. I think I've put that in an Improbable Planet. You'll see a graph that actually shows you how the density of heavy metals rises from the center of our galaxy, hits a peak, then begins to drop, then goes up to another peak and drops off. And as you go into the extreme outer part of our Milky Way galaxy, it becomes a constant.
Thank you, Hugh. Keith in New Zealand says, how do you answer those who accuse you of following secular or naturalistic science?
Well, I get that charge a lot, particularly from young Earth creationists. And, you know, we hear Reasons to Believe take the position that God has inerrantly revealed himself, not just through the book of Scripture, but also through the book of nature. Whereas I notice many of our young Earth friends take the position that when Adam fell, it spoiled the capacity of the book of nature to reveal truth to human beings. So they've written in a number of their articles and books that the only way to reliably interpret the book of nature is through the lens of Scripture. And of course, what they mean is through the lens of their young Earth interpretation. And so our position is that God has given us two books that are from God, and they're books that do overlap, not totally, but they do overlap partially. And when they overlap, they will cohere. And yes, we do agree that because of human sin, our capacity to correctly interpret the book of nature can be flawed. But also we make the point that's true of the book of scripture, is that our human sin likewise can cause us to develop flawed interpretations of the book of scripture. And when I pressed my young earth friends with this, they admit that that's true. They said it's got to be true since we disagree on what the Bible is saying. And so, and just understanding that, you know, the fall of Adam impacted our capacity to interpret two books. And that really gives you a reason why God gave us two books, so that, you know, you can look at in the book of nature, and if it contradicts what you see in the book of scripture, that means you've made an interpretive error, because both books are from the same God for whom it's impossible to lie or deceive. And so that should cause us to dig deeper into our understanding of both books. And, you know, it could be we're interpreting one correctly and one incorrectly. Often what I notice is you run into a situation where you're interpreting both incorrectly. But the fact that God gave us these two books, I think, gives us a check. And also to realize both of those books have subcategories. There are 66 books that make up the Bible. And, you know, since all books are inspired by God, one book can't contradict the other. And so often what I've done with my young earth creationist friends is say, you know, rather than just looking at the book of Genesis, let's also look at the other 65 books, because this is all from God, it must go here. And if you wind up with an interpretation where you got Romans contradicting Genesis, then you know you've made an interpretive error. That also works with the book of nature. The book of nature is composed of multiple subdisciplines of science. And so if we see our biological model contradicting our astronomical model, then we know we've misinterpreted one or the other. And so there's these checks and balances that we have. And that's actually built into the principle of what I call the biblical interpretive method, what my scientist friends call the scientific method. Mainly that we always check our interpretations by other observations, experiments, or in the case of the book of scripture, other biblical texts.
Well, thank you, Hugh. It's 10:45, so let's get started officially.
Okay, I'll open our time in prayer, and then we'll jump into our series. And Father in heaven, we thank you for this day. Thank you for this morning that you've given us this afternoon. And we thank you, Lord, for the people that are able to join us through the use of this technology. And the Lord, I pray that you would enrich our time, and that all of us, regardless of where we are spiritually, would be able to receive more of your love, more of your life, and more of your truth. So help us to be a blessing unto one another and a blessing unto you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Hugh, let me make a couple of announcements, if I could.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. One thing, when you write in a question, please let us know where you are. It makes it a lot more fun. And I want to recommend a couple of books. We talked about this one, Hugh, first. This is Nancy Piercy's book, Finding Truth. I find this to be a really compelling book. She gives a structure for organizing everything we learn about theology and apologetics and philosophy she gives a structure that makes it real easy to witness, and a way to think about it that you don't have to remember all the facts. So I really highly recommend that book. I also want to recommend a book by our friend Travis Campbell, who is part of the apologetics community with Reasons to Believe. He has a book called The Wonderful Decree, Reconciling Sovereign Election and Universal Benevolence. And I haven't read it yet, but I know Travis and we've talked about it, and it's gotten some really excellent reviews on Amazon. So that's what I have to say. Hugh, why don't you tell us what you're going to do this morning?
Well, we tried an experiment last week because we're trying to build some fellowship into this virtual experience, which was to run the webinar through till noon Pacific time. And then from noon till 12:30 Pacific time, we would stop the webinar and open up a meeting. And I gave you a URL for that meeting. That URL will be stable for at least the next 6 weeks. So we're going to use the same URL. So I'm going to teach for about 30 minutes, and then we're going to have Q&A on any subject matter you care to raise. And we'll do it by the normal Q&A feature. And then at noon, we will stop the webinar, and then you'll get an invitation to join the meeting. And the advantage there is webinar, I can't break you up into groups and turn on all your video, but I can do that in meeting. And people have asked, well, can't we do this seamlessly? That is coming. I hear that Zoom will be bringing out software that will enable us to do that seamlessly. But for now, I have to stop the webinar and then open up the meeting. And last week, it took me about 90 seconds to terminate the webinar and get the meeting started. So I just encourage all of you to be patient. But yeah, I'll be showing you the URL at the end of the teaching time, and I'll show you again just before we stop the webinar at noon. But yeah, I really enjoyed the group I was in, because the way the software works, we all get randomly dropped into groups of four or five. And that's the way you can actually get to know one another. You can turn your cameras on, turn your microphones on. And you know, we can do this without fear of being Zoom bombed, because the only people that are able to get in are people that are actually part of the webinar. So I enjoyed it. It's a good way to get to meet people. I hear about their testimonies, where they are in their spiritual journey. But what I'm going to be doing for the next 6 weeks is actually ending the teaching time with a discussion question for the small groups. And incidentally, this is totally voluntary. So anyone who wants to participate can. And you know, you're welcome to share the URL with people you trust, because there's probably people out there that say, you know what, I'm not available for the teaching and Q&A time, but I'd love to be able to participate in the meeting. That is possible, but I'm going to trust all of you to invite people that you can trust not to abuse that privilege. So with that, I'm going to share a screen. And incidentally, we do record all these classes. And so they're all posted at paradoxes.org. So anyone can go to paradoxes.org and download for free the recordings of past classes. And that also includes a recording of the Q&A time. So let me go to the share feature here. Okay, you all should be seeing my first slide here. And this is where we ended up last week. Basically, we went through an interesting research paper published by Lawrence Krauss and Glenn Starkman, where they basically took us through what's going to happen to the universe in the future. And basically, they were putting to the test the claim made by Carl Sagan that the universe is all there is or was or ever will be. They said, if the universe is the totality of reality, what does that mean for the future of humanity and life? And basically, they concluded that now that we know that the universe is dominated by dark energy, it's going to continue to expand. Moreover, it's going to expand at a faster and faster rate as it gets older and older. And eventually, it'll be expanding so fast that you're not going to get heat flow from hot bodies to cold bodies. And when that happens, it's no longer going to be possible to accumulate information. In fact, you're going to lose information and eventually know nothing at all. And eventually, it terminates the possibility of metabolism and therefore life. And they conclude their paper by saying that there's an inevitable end to all consciousness if indeed the universe is all there was or is or ever will be. But that kind of leads you to the conclusion that in that case, if the universe is all there is, not a single human being has any hope, purpose, meaning, or destiny. We we're no better off than a rock. As I mentioned, that was actually the conclusion of a debate I had with a particle physicist, Victor Stenger. They gave him the last word in the debate, and that's what he said, as remember, we're all cold nothing. We're no better than a proton, an electron. We're no better than a speck of dust. We're all gonna have the same fate. And so it's a myth that we have any hope, purpose, meaning, or destiny. Now, the Bible contradicts, however, what Carl Sagan said. It reveals that there is a two creation model. And, you know, part of my story is I became a Christian through spending a couple of years going through the world's holy books and noticed that the Bible stood alone. It's not that the other holy books didn't speak about a heaven. It's just that the heaven they spoke about was a heaven that could be realized within the physics and the dimensions of the universe in which we're in. It really wasn't an independent creation. Whereas when you read the Bible, it talks about God creating this universe and speaking into existence, and that there will be a time in the future when God will speak it out of existence and replace the universe with a brand new creation, a new creation with radically different physics and radically different dimensions. So unlike anything you see in any other holy book. And, you know, just kind of going through this and realizing the Bible is distinct, not only in that way, but in many other ways. There are doctrines in the Bible you don't find in any other holy book, like the doctrine of the Trinity, like the doctrine of eternal security, how we can have an eternally secure relationship with our Creator and actually gain that security in this creation, and how there is not only human free will, we're all held responsible for our actions, our words, and our thoughts, but that God predetermines all our thoughts, words, and actions. And again, that's unique to the Bible, but that was a piece of evidence for me as a teenager in my late teens to realize, you know, these other books, they read like they've been written by human beings from a human context. When I picked up the Bible, it read like it came from someone that transcends the physics of the universe, that transcends the dimensions of the universe. And so I said, of all these holy books I've been looking at, this alone has a possibility of actually coming from the God that created the universe. And I got to share my testimony in a conference yesterday, basically making the point, it was the book of nature that brought me to the recognition that there had to be a God. Had to be a God beyond space and time. And that also eventually drew me into studying the Bible that was out there. So this is a unique feature of the Christian faith, is that it's a two creation model, which means there really is hope. There really is purpose and destiny and meaning for us human beings. It's just that it doesn't lie in this universe. It lies beyond the universe. And I've mentioned before in our series, you see a Bible verse, Ecclesiastes 3:11, that states that God has written eternity on the hearts of every human being. And that's something that I've observed. The atheists that I debate, atheist scientists, again, with the rare exception of Victor Stenger, they all insist that in spite of the fact that there is no God, that there's nothing beyond the universe, they insist they actually have hope, purpose, meaning, and destiny. They by and large, adhere to the fact that we should live a moral life. And there's you know, some obvious meaning and purpose behind that morality. But where does it come from if indeed the universe is all there is or was or ever will be? And so there's something within us. God has written his law on our hearts. We human beings, the only species of life that are concerned about measuring up and living up to a moral standard. We're also the only creatures that are concerned about any purpose or meaning in our lives. Now, something I've noticed in my debates and dialogues with people who are not theists, they presume that Christianity really does believe that God created the universe, but created the universe to be a home for us human beings. And I had a dialogue with an atheist just yesterday on my Twitter page, basically saying there really can't be a God like the God described in the Bible, because when you look at the universe, it really isn't best fit to provide humans with a home. It's like, look at all the waste space. Look at all these useless galaxies. And they're making the mistake of thinking that the only reason why God created the universe is to provide a home for life, and provide a home in particular for us human beings. And because of the assumption that there's only one purpose for God creating the universe, they draw the assumption that the universe is a bad design, that there's actually a better way we could design the universe to provide a home for human beings. And that's akin to the point of view that the human body is a bad design. Again, if all you're looking at is one purpose for the human body, or one function, like being able to sit, or being able to stand, or run, or be prone, then indeed you could say, if all we're looking at is one purpose, there is a better way we could design the human body. But there isn't a better way if indeed we're designing the human body to fulfill multiple purposes, and to be able to fulfill those multiple purposes for a long time. The same principle applies to the universe. And so what we realize just from looking at the Bible, and this is not a complete list, God designed the universe not only so that humans can live on planet Earth, but so that billions of us can live on this planet at one time, and live with a standard of living whereby we can hear and respond to the gospel message and enter into an eternal relationship with our Creator. So a big mistake that atheists make is thinking that if there's a God, his purpose for creating the universe is simply to provide a home for human beings. No, it's to provide a home where billions of us can live at one time. And billions of us live on a planet small enough where we can have relationships with one another. Because I've heard that from atheists too. If God wanted billions of human beings, why didn't he spread us out over a much bigger planet? He could have done that, but it meant that we would have been separated from one another to a greater degree. And incidentally, there's very good scientific reasons why human life is not possible on a bigger planet. I'm actually writing about that now in a book that I'm finishing up on interior designs of the major components of the universe all the way down to the Earth, making the point that we are living on a planet. And given the laws of physics, it's the largest planet possible if you want human beings on it. There is a way to have human life on a planet where the planet is smaller, but you can't have it for a planet that is bigger. So God gave us the biggest possible living space that is imaginable. But also to realize that one purpose of God creating the universe is for evil to be eternally eradicated. And this is kind of where we're going in this series, is that, you know, non-theists argue that there can't be a God, because if there's an all-powerful God that's all-loving, he wouldn't subject us to evil. Well, it could be that this evil and suffering we're experiencing has a purpose. And if the evil and suffering is temporary and brief, then this could actually fit in with an all-powerful, all-loving God. And we'll get into that more as we move into the series. And then for human free will capabilities to be enhanced, because God's goal is that redeemed humans would gain a capacity to experience and express love exponentially greater than they are right now. And keep in mind, God created another species of intelligent life, angels, and he created the universe in such a way that it could be a tool of instruction for the angels. Well, that's probably the most obvious reasons we see stated in the Bible for why God made the universe the way he did. And it's kind of like our human body. When you've got multiple purposes and the purposes are quite distinct from one another, there's going to be design trade-offs. And so that answers the atheist objection, where they said, look, if God designed the universe for this specific purpose, there's a better way it could be done, but there's not a better way for that to happen in the context of God fulfilling that purpose and many other purposes as well. Last week, again, I gave you the analogy is that it's not possible to purchase an automobile that's got the best gas mileage of any automobile in the market, and at the same time, the best engine performance, a car that can accelerate from 0 to 60, say in 3 seconds, and be able to go 250 miles per hour and have a great handling going around sharp corners, and at the same time, get great gas mileage. We all know from driving automobiles that the faster you drive that automobile, your gas mileage goes down. And if you're starting and stopping constantly, being aggressive on the brake and the accelerator, again, that will degrade your gas mileage. On the other hand, most cars in the market are a compromise. They give you good performance, and at the same time, they give you good gas mileage. It's not perfect, optimal, but they trade off a little bit, so you get the benefit of both. And this is what we see in the universe in which we're looking at. But what I want to do in the next few minutes is actually expand upon these creation purposes, because I think a good way to engage people who are not yet followers of Jesus Christ is not just to focus on one or two purposes, but to actually take them through a fairly lengthy list. And the list I'm going to show you here is not complete, but I've found from experience by taking skeptics who are not yet Christians through this list of a dozen, I'm going to take you through a dozen of these, that it opens up things that they've never really thought about and really gets them thinking of the idea, okay, there are multiple purposes for the universe being the way it is, and I've been mistaken in thinking that it's a bad design. And what I see is really elegant designs, and they begin to recognize that they've been mistaken and thinking there's no God behind it, that there really is a very intelligent and a knowledgeable creator behind it all. And just amazed, that's something that amazes me, is just saying, isn't it incredible the way the universe has been designed to be able to fulfill all dozen of these purposes? And again, this is not a complete list, but I picked these dozen that I'm going to show you as the ones that I personally found most effective of getting people who are not yet believers to be able to say, wow, I've never thought about that. That's something I need to take into context as a way to get them to begin to consider changing their worldview. Okay, we'll begin with this list here. And a number one on the list is one that I think everybody accepts, that indeed, if there is a God, then one purpose of the universe is he created it so not only can primitive life exist, but we human beings exist and be able to thrive. And, we all realize that human beings exist. And I found that even atheist scientists acknowledge it takes a lot of fine-tuning design of the universe to get a planet on which humans can exist. And I added the word thrive because we're not just kind of eking out a living here on planet Earth. It is such that we're not only able to exist, but to actually thrive. And what I mean by that, be able to have a long lifespan, have it to be productive, to be able to launch civilization, to have technology and learning. The amazing thing is that we're not only able to survive on planet Earth, but we're able to survive in such a way that only 1% of us has to be concerned about providing food for the population. The rest of us can engage in music and art and literature, science, technology, the study of history. And so, and these are things that we human beings have been designed to enjoy. And a second purpose is that the universe has been designed so that not only can we humans exist, but diverse life can exist with us. And I probably should have added that phrase, exist and thrive with us. That would be a good edit. I'll try to do that for the future. So we live on this planet, you know, with 8.5 million, 8.6 million is the latest calculation for the number of eukaryotic species on the face of the Earth. And there may be another 10 million prokaryotic species on the face of the Earth. The difference is the eukaryotic life forms are those life forms where the cells have a nucleus, where the chromosomes are in the nucleus, where you have a distinct nucleus relative to the rest of the cell, as opposed to the periode. Sorry, I'm having problems pronouncing that. Anyway, simple microbes that are there. And the eukaryotic life forms are those life forms. Many of them are unicellular, but all multicellular life forms are eukaryotic. And, you know, I cited a paper in a couple of my books indicating that we now have a fairly accurate count of the total number of these more complex life forms on planet Earth. It's 8.6 million. But I think what's most interesting, the research shows that the number of distinct species of eukaryotic life forms has been increasing from the origin of life 3.8 billion years ago to the present day. And that we humans were placed here on planet Earth at that time when the number of species was at a maximum. And so it's been going from zero up to 8.6 million. That's where we were when God created Adam and Eve. The number of species, especially of the more advanced species, has declined since then, mainly because of human sin and abuse. But the whole point is God designed the universe and the Earth in particular in such a way that not only can we exist and thrive, but these millions of species can exist and thrive. And what I found most interesting about the research, that number 8.6 million, that's approximately what you would get from the theoretical maximum. So we're actually living on this planet with a theoretically maximum possible number of species of life. And so God wanted us human beings to exist on this planet where we got this incredible diversity, a theoretically maximum diversity of life here on planet Earth. And really explains why our planet Earth is the way it is. It's not just so that we can exist on it, but it's so that all these other species can exist on it. And incidentally, it answers the question about why we have so many different insect species. And it's because of a physics approach to the diversity of life. If you've got a planet that's, you know, 13,000 kilometers across, 8,000 miles across, there's actually a size, a body size, where you're going to get the maximum diversity. And that body size happens to be about 1 centimeter. So it's no accident that we've got 500,000 different species of beetles. Given the theoretical limitations on the diversity of life, you're going to get the greatest diversity of possible species, given the dimensions of our planet Earth, for life forms that are about 1 centimeter across. And so, but again, as you look at the whole spread of life on planet Earth, life forms that are 1 meter across, for example, they're at the theoretical maximum. Everything's close to the theoretical maximum for the diversity of life on planet Earth. And number three here is that God designed the universe in such a way as to teach us human beings spiritual lessons. And this is connected. I put it purposely after number two, because we were talking about the book of Proverbs during our first Q&A session from 10:30 to 10:45. And, you know, making the point that in Proverbs, it's basically telling us how these diverse life forms can teach us human beings lessons, and not just science lessons, but spiritual lessons. And you see that particularly in the book of Job. And I could give a short plug here. I wrote a book back in 2014, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, basically making the point that when you go through the entirety of the book of Job, it addresses how God created certain species of life, but in particular animal species of life, to teach us human beings spiritual lessons. And so you got Job, for example, in chapter 12, making the statement to his three friends that he's been debating, you know, look to the beasts of the field, look to the birds of the sky, and they will teach you lessons. And what he meant was that they would teach spiritual lessons. And I find it interesting that as human beings have increasingly become disconnected from these animals that God designed to teach us spiritual lessons, we see a rise in people that adopt an agnostic, an atheistic worldview, or what they call a nun view, where they don't really follow any particular religion. There's a direct correlation between the increasing percentage of the human population. By the way, it's not large. We're talking about an increase from 0.1% up to 11 or 12%. But most of that increase has happened in the past few decades when humans moved off of the rural parts of the planet and into big urban centers. But as they moved into these big, dense urban centers, they've been cut off from these animals that God had created and designed to teach us spiritual lessons. I'm not going to go into all those spiritual lessons. I address them in some detail in the book, Hidden Treasures, in the book of Job, basically making the point that, you know, these animals were designed to relate to a higher life form, and namely us human beings. Likewise, we humans were designed to relate to a higher life form. And as our sin causes these animals to run away from us instead of towards us, likewise, our sin causes us to run away from a higher being instead of towards that higher being. And as it takes a higher being to tame and domesticate these birds and mammals that God created to teach us, likewise, it takes God to tame and domesticate us. So that's just a few. I talk about seven distinct spiritual lessons that these animals teach us, but that requires that the universe be a certain way so that not only do we have a place where we humans can exist, we have a place where all these diverse life forms can exist, and in particular, birds and mammals that are able to teach us these spiritual lessons. And I also have argued in several of my reasons.org articles, we actually have lessons being taught to us from the plants, the trees and the grass. And you see that likewise, that we're to look to the lilies of the field, the grass, the trees, they will teach us things. And it will teach us not only lessons about science, but about our relationship with God and how we can come into a relationship with God. And the universe was designed to demonstrate God's divine nature. You know, I find that just simply helping people understand the extent and the diversity of the universe actually communicates to them just the power that God has, his benevolence. I mean, you know, it's going back to all these life forms that God created, we realize the huge diversity actually speaks to God's extravagance in creating. He didn't have to create all these different life forms, but he wanted to do that in order that we can experience the joy of living in relationship with all these plants and animals and microbes and viruses and bacteria, but at the same time to benefit from the spiritual lessons that they can teach us. And again, I want to emphasize that, probably should have put that in here too, is that God designed the universe and earth in such a way that we could experience joy in relating to the different components of the universe and just be blown away by, for example, looking at the extent of the universe. And, you know, we see that even in the back in the book of Genesis. Look to the stars, see if you can count all those stars. And, you know, the earliest humans were well aware that these stars were extremely distant. They tried to measure the distance and weren't able to do it. They recognized that these had to be objects just like our sun. And that just kind of blew them away about just how vast the universe must be. And here's a God that created all that. And again, he wanted us to enjoy it. And I could recommend, there's something called Astronomy Picture of the Day. It's managed by NASA, and every day they post a new picture, a new photograph, a new image of some component of the universe. And there's now thousands of images on that site, and every day they put up a new one. But as you go through the archive of these astronomy pictures of the day, I think it blows away anybody, atheists included, just the incredible elegance and beauty we see in these objects that make of the universe. And there's no life there, but you can't get away from the fact that it's gorgeous to look at. And that's something I think God wanted us. He designed the universe in such a way that we would see his desire to express beauty and elegance and extravagance in everything that he creates. And that's just a little bit of God's divine nature. We're told in Romans 1 that every human being is without excuse in terms of being ignorant about God, because it says God created the universe in such a way that it not only reveals his existence, it reveals his particular personal attributes. And again, we just covered a few, but it's also designed in such a way to show us our own human nature, and sort of recognize that there's a big difference between the nature of God and our human nature. We see the moral perfection of God, we see his love, and we see our inability to manifest that. And the fact that we're in rebellion against God, and we're failing to meet up to the standards that God has written on our hearts. Number six, God has designed the universe in such a way that not only can we humans exist, but we humans can exist on a single planet and develop global high technology civilization. And I think we're actually seeing that, for example, when you look at infants. Even though they're only a few months old, they seem to have this innate capacity to engage high technology. And you know, something I've been thinking about for years is that, you know, long before we human beings developed computers and telephones and the internet and all this, it's like God had already built into the human body the capacity to use all this high technology. I mean, you actually see it, for example, in music, is that long before we had these pianos, God gave us the dexterity in our hands to be able to play a Liszt piano concerto. Not that all of us can do that, but a few of us can. And long before we had computers, God gave us the manual dexterity to be able to type 100 words a minute. And so if you go back thousands of years, there really was no reason why we had to have that built-in dexterity. I mean, for thousands of years, there were no pianos. For thousands of years, there were no computers, no typewriters, and no real need. So I don't think this is something you can say just simply evolved in humanity. When God created us, we were endowed with these capabilities from the get-go, long before, thousands of years before, there was any capacity to actually make use of these things. And one thing we know about naturalistic evolution, the way it works is that if there hasn't been a purpose, it goes away. But we retained these amazing capabilities. And here we are in the 21st century. And now, for the first time, we're able to make full use of what God endowed within us from the very beginning. The ability to actually sit in front of a computer and just actually use our brains in such a way we're able to think logically and rationally in such a way that we can be very productive. And I believe this is a tool that God gave us to engage one another and to discover more about him. Well, these are the next seven. I'm going to try to get through this before we end. To display God's glory and goodness, and realize as we look out at the earth and the universe and how he's provided for all of his creatures, he's not only provided for us, as Jesus was making the comment, he provides for the birds of the field. All life forms have that provision. He takes care of them all. And then for the rapid, efficient conquest of evil. And you know what? I think I'm going to save some of this for next week, because there's a lot I wanted to say about the angels and how God designed the universe to be a platform for his redemption. So I was a bit ambitious this time, but we'll pick this up next week, and we'll start there. And actually, I'll give you a little bit of a hint of where we're going to go next. I'll come back to this in a minute. But actually begin to look at what the second creation is like. And because these other six we're going to talk about really fit into the fact that God is preparing us for careers in the new creation. And, again, I remember yesterday in a conference that my wife and I participated in, she was talking about how when she was first introduced to the subject of heaven as a child, being raised in a Christian home, unlike me, the vision of heaven they gave her was the fact that we're all going to be singing hymns and playing musical instruments on clouds. And it's like, if that's all there is to the new creation, I don't see why everybody's so excited about going there. But we're actually going to get into that and really see how the new creation, we're going to have very challenging careers. And because of these challenging careers and how each of us is going to have a distinct career, we're not all going to be doing the same thing. God made us all different. That's another marvel of creation. Every human being is distinct from every other human being. Why? Because God has designed a career, a specific independent career for us to fulfill in the new creation. And it's such a challenging career that it takes being exposed to the first creation to be prepared and trained for the new creation. So that's where we'll be going next week. Let me stop at this point, and we'll end the screen sharing. And we'll go back, we'll do Q&A. Oh, let me go back to the share, because for those of you who didn't get the URL, because this is where we're going to be going at 12 noon Pacific time. Here it is. So come noon, I'm going to stop the webinar, and give me a little bit of time, and I'll open up the Zoom meeting. And the Zoom meeting, I'll have the capability of turning on all your microphones and cameras, and then we'll go into small groups. And as we go into those small groups, I want you to get to know one another. Find out where you are in your spiritual journey, how you got there, maybe how you discovered the Paradoxes class, but also to have some dialogue with one another on the multiple purposes for God creating the universe the way he did. So this is the URL you're going to need to get into that. So if you could write that down or take a photograph of it with your smartphone, that's how you're going to be able to get in to the Zoom meeting when we stop the webinar. And that'll happen approximately at noon. And I'll put this up again just before we shut down the webinar. But I'll leave it up for a few more seconds to give you time to write it down. And the key thing you're going to need are those last few digits, 843-456-80354. So... And Ross and Mark, you can begin to collect questions from people as I leave this up for a few more seconds. And then we'll
quite a few going already.
Okay.
We're ready to go.
All right, let me stop the share here. Okay.
Very good. I just want to tell everybody that if you missed that, it's in the chat box if you open that up. So Jerry Boudreau asks, does the ever increasing expanding universe have any impact on the six tiny dimensions? And Hugh, maybe you can explain what he's asking there.
Yes, namely that the universe was started off with 10, well, 9 dimensions of space and 1 dimension of time. And those 9 dimensions of space rapidly expanded from the cosmic creation event. But when gravity separated out from the other 3 forces of physics, and that happened very early in the history of the universe, it happened when the universe was only 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. At that moment, 6 of the 9 dimensions of space stopped expanding. So they're still here, but they're no bigger than what they were when the universe was 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. And where are they? They're wrapped very tightly around the 3 large dimensions of length, width, and height. And they're wrapped so tightly around the 3 big dimensions that the cross-section of those 6 tiny dimensions measures 20 orders of magnitude smaller than the diameter of an electron. So that's why people haven't really noticed them in their measurements of the physics of the universe. And you say, how do we know these extra dimensions exist? It's really the only way we can actually get consistency between our particle physics creation models and our cosmological creation models. And so this is a research project for over 15 years by a number of people I knew at Caltech. And it took them a while to realize, okay, we want gravity and we want quantum mechanics and relativity and particle physics and cosmology to all cohere. We need these 6 extra tiny dimensions. But yes, we can't observe them. The evidence we have for them is theoretical, simply based on the assumption that all these different factors in physics must cohere. Now, there is one model of the ongoing expansion of the universe called the Big Rip, which is basically saying, as the universe continues to expand at a more and more rapid rate, there comes a time in the future of the universe when it so stresses the space dimensions of the universe that these dimensions actually shatter. It shatters all remaining particles in the universe, shatters the space-time dimensionality, and the Big Rip model says that's how the universe will come to an end. But it's only one way the universe could come to an end. And as I mentioned last week or a couple of weeks ago, the first thing that's going to happen with the ongoing expansion of the universe is that you reach a point, and it's only like 10 to the 35 years off into the future when all ordinary matter disappears because all the protons are going to decay. And when there's no more protons or neutrons, there's no possibility for physical life. There's no possibility for planets and stars and galaxies. So, but the Big Rip would happen much later than that.
Thank you, Hugh. David Edwards asks, in chapter 11 of your book, Weathering Climate Change, you show how unique our sun is. 4 similar stars that we have found that have no twins. I'm curious to know if all stars are unique. If there are no 2 stars alike, like fingerprints, then we would not expect to find a twin for our sun.
Yeah, it's all based on your definition of a twin. Just like all human beings are different, including identical twins. But most of us, when we look at identical twins, can't tell the difference. But if you actually look very closely, there is a difference. And so likewise, astronomers cannot measure the properties of stars with such great precision and diversity. They can actually see the distinctives. I would expect that all stars are different from one another, but a number of astronomers have been focused on trying to find another star that's sufficiently like the sun that it could be a candidate to have a planet orbiting it on which advanced life is possible. And so far, they've not been able to find such a twin, but they've also made note in their research papers, if we use the same kind of definition for identifying stars that are similar to one another, we realize that many other stars have twins, but the sun, we're not able to find a twin given a similar narrow definition of a twin.
Thank you, Hugh. Stephen Posta, again in Spring, Texas, says one of the more contentious discussions this summer for astrophysicists has been centered on a possibility that, quote, Planet Nine may not be a planet, but instead is a black hole deep in our solar system. If this actually is the case, how does it affect fine-tuning of our solar system?
Yeah, the debate that's been going on, and I do address this in a couple of my books, and you'll also see some articles in reasons.org, is that if you go into the distant comet belts of our solar system, way beyond the orbit of Neptune, we do see that the orbits of certain comets overlap in a small space. And it's like that overlap suggests that there may be a single relatively massive body that's causing all those orbits to overlap the way they do. And so people have said this might be a Planet Nine that's out there that's causing this. Other astronomers have said, now, wait a minute. There are other ways we can explain the overlap of those orbits. We don't need another planet to do that. There's ways that the comets could engage one another in such way that you would get that. And then somebody said, well, maybe we got a really small black hole out there that could do the same thing. But it's similar to the idea that there's a ninth planet out there that's causing this. Now, the ninth planet model, what it's got going for it is that in order to explain the rocky planets in our solar system, we got Mercury, we got Venus, we got the Earth, we got Mars. What you notice is those rocky planets get more massive as you move farther away from the sun. But Mars doesn't fit. Mars, given our understanding of how planets form, it should be more massive than the Earth, at least 50% more massive than the Earth, but it's not. It's only one-ninth the mass of the Earth. And so this is called the Mars problem. But what solves the Mars problem is if the solar system begins not just with two gas giants and two ice giants, the gas giants being Jupiter and Saturn, and the ice giants being Uranus and Neptune. But if you've got three ice giants, where one of those ice giants gets kicked out of the solar system by gravitational interactions with Jupiter and or Saturn. And so the fact that we got this small planet Mars beyond the orbit of the Earth gives some additional evidence that yes, there could be a planet out there. Because to explain the Mars problem, there's two ways it can be done. You get an ice giant that gets kicked out completely from the solar system, or it gets kicked out to such a great distance, it's still part of the solar system, but it's going to be orbiting about 50 times farther away from the sun than Neptune is, which means it's going to be far enough away, it's not going to be easy to detect. But there are astronomers who hold that view, who are trying to measure more carefully the overlap of these comet orbits beyond Neptune to see if they can actually predict where this ninth planet would be and therefore hopefully be able to detect it. They determined that if it is responsible for the overlap of these orbits, it'd be approximately 10 times more massive than the Earth, orbiting about 50 times more distant from the sun than Neptune is, which means there is a potential to detect it if we can get an accurate position for it. On the other hand, we can explain all those overlaps without that ninth planet. So it's an unsettled issue at this point. I'm skeptical of the idea that there's a small black hole rather than a planet that's responsible for this. For the simple reason is we don't see any small black holes anywhere else in our galaxy. The smallest black hole we see comes in at about three times more massive than our star, the sun. And to make this work, you would need a black hole orders of magnitude less massive to explain that overlap. And there's some good theoretical physics that actually would predict that the universe is not going to have black holes that small. You really need exotic physics to get black holes that small, but explains why people are excited about it, saying, hey, if there is a black hole is responsible for the overlap of those planetary orbits, that gives us physics that we've never even thought about before. And I think that's important for lay people to realize. There is a group of theoretical physicists out there that are really eager to try to find some exotic addition to the standard physics that we see explaining the universe and particle physics. And so there's this goal to try to find some super exotic physics. And therefore they say, well, if we find one of these tiny black holes, that means we got some super exotic physics. But again, the way to check all these speculations, I don't really give them any credence until we actually have observational evidence that supports that. And currently we don't.
Thank you, Hugh. Yuven has a question. He says, Dr. Ross, have you interacted with Jewish believers regarding RTB's view on Genesis 1 and 2, and how do they respond typically?
Yes, we've had quite a bit. I mean, just simply the fact that we're in the Los Angeles basin area. We have one of the larger Jewish populations. And so, you and Mark both know we've had a number of Jews come through the class. And what's interesting is that we had one Jew who was engaging five rabbis. And the rabbis would feed him with questions to ask in the class, but they would never come to the class. So it was interesting. We had a relationship with five rabbis that never came to the class, but they kept feeding questions. And, the experience that I've had, not only with those Jews directly in the Paradoxes class, but Jews that I just met living in the LA basin and traveling to places like New York, I've been to Israel myself, is they claim that we Christians have made a mistake, particularly on interpreting Genesis 1. And then the mistake they identify is that passage where God says, let us create, humans, male and female. And so you see that particular passage, Genesis 1, 25 and 26, where God refers to creating human beings, but refers to himself with both singular pronouns and plural pronouns. And as a Christian, I look at that as evidence that here in Genesis chapter 1, it's teaching that God is a triune being. Because he uses the name for God, Elohim, which means the uniplural one, and he actually explicitly, on purpose, changes the pronouns from singular, making the point that there's one God, but the plural, making the point that there's one God as manifested in distinct persons. Now, the way rabbis and Orthodox devout Jews have responded to that is to say, when it uses a plural pronoun, it's the royal we. And so God is actually including the angelic realm as being with him, observing him creating. Now, the way I've responded to that to my Jewish friends is to say, it's actually not just saying that the plural is passively observing what the singular God is doing. It's actually attributing creative power to that plural pronoun. And so the idea that God's including the angels as a royal we, from my perspective, does not work. And we got explicit texts. Both in the Tanakh, the Old Testament, and especially in the book of Hebrews, where it's making the point, angels have not been granted the capacity to create. There's only one creator. You see that in the book of Isaiah. When we studied Isaiah and paradoxes, we looked at all those passages where it made the point, there's only one creator. Only God can create. The angels can't do that. So I don't think it works to try to claim that that's royal we. Now, to the credit of, devout Jews, their printing of the Tanakh, they always put the comment about the royal we as a footnote. They don't put it into the text. So, yeah, I do appreciate that they're honest enough to make the point that this is their particular interpretation. But, yeah, every one of their Tanakh, you'll actually see a little asterisk beside that verse, and then a comment at the bottom that don't worry about the plural pronoun. This is just the royal we.
Thank you, Hugh. Norm Helgeson has a good question. He's here in Los Angeles area. He says, what are the Bible's clearest statements regarding slavery? Is it legal or illegal, moral or immoral? In Philemon, Paul's concern seems to be more that Onesimus had violated the law of running away from his master and doesn't want him to be punished for that, as opposed to the evil of slavery. Are there other clear statements?
Very good question. And let me just add, Ross, to the last comment, because I think the idea about Jews and their views on Genesis and creation, I need to add that it's just like in Christianity. You got young earth Jews, you got old earth Jews. You got those who take it from a theistic evolutionary perspective and those who take it from a creation perspective. So just like you see this range of different interpretations of Genesis and the other creation texts in the Bible, you see a similar range amongst devout Jews. Incidentally, I've also seen that amongst Muslims, because Muslims, after all, add their book to the Old and New Testament. So in their interpretation of the Old Testament, it's just like Christians and Jews. There's a wide range of different views. Okay, with respect to the question that's on the table here, give it to me again, Ross.
Yeah, he's basically asking about what does the Bible say about slavery? Many people are criticizing slavery. It because it seems like it doesn't take a strong stand against it. And I think that's his question.
Yeah, good question. Probably the best answer I've seen to that question is at the Museum of the Bible Museum Row in Washington, D.C. I've seen their exhibit. It's a relatively new exhibit, and it's the best response I've seen to what the Bible says about slavery, because what they actually do is take you back in the days before the Civil War, and there were Christians on two sides. One group was actually saying that the Bible explicitly teaches against slavery. Another group were saying it was pro-slavery. And what they do is they have these display where they basically show you the debate that's going on. But what's most interesting there at the Museum of the Bible is that those Christians are trying to argue that there is no biblical injunction against slavery. They were basically taking verses out of the Bible. And so they show you, for example, the Bible that they gave to their slaves. But the Bible they gave to the slaves didn't have the book of Exodus in it. They took the entire book out. And they not only removed that, they removed passages from Proverbs that were taken out. They removed passages from the New Testament. They basically removed from the Bible all those passages that are anti-slavery. And then they show you the position of the abolitionists, how they provided slaves and slave owners. What they did is they went through the entire Bible and pulled out all the passages that are relevant to slavery. And they included the passages that the pro-slavery people quote. For example, passages about slaves obeying their masters and slaves serving their masters. Those are in the New Testament. And some modern Bibles will translate those passages as employees and employers. And I think they're making a good point with that kind of a translation, basically saying that all of us are under authority and we are to respect those that are over us in authority and realize even those that are bosses, they're under authority too. I mean, you own your own company, Ross, and you realize that people that are your bosses are your customers. They're the ones that rule over you. Yep. And you need to respect them if you're going to stay in business. And so it's just making the point we're all under authority. And regardless of how that authority is structured, those under authority are to respect those over an authority. But notice that those passages are all also balanced, that those in authority are to be kind and take good care and be responsible to those that are under their authority. So it's making it very clear, if you've been given authority, you're not to abuse those people that are under you in authority. And I think the question was looking at the book of Philemon. And when I read the book of Philemon, to me, it's the tenderest writing of all of Paul's epistles. He's basically appealing to his friend and saying, I'm sending back your slave Onesimus. And I want to just tell you the degree that he has served me. He was under no compunction to serve me. I was not his master. And yet this is what he did for me. And I'm sending him back. And I know as one an authority under Roman law, you could have him killed. But given the way he has blessed me and treated me and the kindness, I want you to receive him back as a valuable servant. And he never commands him to set his slave free, but the very fact that he refers to him, you need to value him for who he is, his capacity, his demeanor. And so he's certainly leaving open the possibility that he should set that slave free. But yeah, you can go online to the Museum of the Bible and just see how potent the Bible is in basically talking about the evils of slavery. And notice, you know, a lot of the pro-slavery people are saying, well, God granted the capacity for Jews to have slaves in terms of the people they conquered. But what they're overlooking was they were commanded to set those slaves free after a certain period of time. The Bible never condones permanent slavery. It's basically saying, okay, you got this person. And you see this in the New Testament too, that those who are slave owners need to realize their slaves are twice as valuable as employees and need to honor and treat them in that capacity, but also to recognize that after a certain period of serving, they need to be set free. And so that was a problem, what was going on before the Civil War. There was no pathway for upward mobility. And incidentally, I think that applies even when you don't have any slaves at all. Regardless of how we're structured as a human society, we need to provide a pathway for upward mobility for all of our citizens. And I'm not going to get into politics, but I think there's a lot in that biblical principle that needs to be applied in the United States today, because not all of our citizens have an equal pathway to upward mobility. You know, I'm grateful for the fact that I was raised in Canada. My parents were poor, but the way the education system was set up in Canada, even though I was in a very poor family, I was granted a pathway to get a high education. All I had to do is maintain high enough grades. And, you know, my dad commented, he said, you know, if I made $100 or less per year, you would have all of your way paid for, your tuition, your books, your living expenses. But because he made $100 over the limit, I only got half of my tuition paid, and I had to pay for all my books and pay for all my living expenses. On the other hand, there was a means by which I was able to get a job to make all of that possible. So I think there's principles there. I mean, we can look down on our noses and say, gee, those people living in the early 1800s, living in the South, look how evil they were. But I think we need to look at ourselves and say, you know, there are shortcomings in our society today that we need to correct. So the principle of upward mobility, I think, is something that people often miss when they look at those passages relevant to slavery.
Thank you, Hugh. Tonette from the Atlanta area has a question. She says, what are your thoughts on the Abraham Accords that were signed this past week, and how do they fit into Bible prophecy about Israel?
Well, I have to confess ignorance here. I'm not aware of this Abraham Accord, so I'm not going to comment on it, but if the person asking the question could give us some context, I could. Who was it that asked the question?
Tonette.
Let's give her some time to type in a little more. Let's take another question and come back to Tonette.
Sure. Well, she has another question. We'll ask that one. She says, there have been some headlines in the last few weeks saying that there are signs of life on Venus. Why do you think there may be hints of life in the atmosphere of Venus?
Okay, good question. And I actually addressed that in an article I wrote exactly 1 month before the phosphine discovery was announced. And it's up on our website. It's an article I wrote about answering the question, is it possible for life to exist in the upper clouds of Venus? And what I did in that article is make the point that the most life-friendly location in the entire solar system beyond planet Earth are the upper clouds of Venus. I mean, the surface of Venus is extremely hot, but as you go up in the atmosphere, the temperature reaches a point where it's the same temperature that is on the surface of the Earth. So we solve the heat problem there. And I also made the point that Venus is relatively close to planet Earth. And so just like big meteoroids that have impacted the Earth have caused Earth's soil to be ejected from the Earth's gravitational pull. And a lot of that stuff has been deposited on the moon. Likewise, a lot's been deposited into the upper clouds of Venus. And this phosphine that they found was announced a week ago. I think last Monday is when they announced it. They found it at 40 parts per billion. And that's an extremely low abundance level. But the article was making the point that, you know, phosphine is very difficult to manufacture without life. You know, life forms do make phosphine. And so they were hinting that this phosphine they found in the upper clouds of Venus could be the remains of life. And given that it's 40 parts per billion, all of that, or at least a significant part of that, could be simply the remains of Earth life that's been deposited into the upper clouds of Venus. And you know, something that I wrote about on my Facebook page is we should anticipate more discoveries like this, because what is happening in the astronomical community is that our capacity to discover complex carbonaceous molecules, the molecules that are typified in life forms, we've gone from being able to make those measurements at one part per million to one part per billion. And, you know, for example, as we study these dense interstellar molecular clouds, we've already discovered over 135 carbonaceous, distinct carbonaceous molecules in those clouds. I'm predicting we're going to find a whole bunch more, because based on what we already know exists in those clouds, we know the chemistry operates to make many more carbonaceous molecules, and especially many more of the more complex carbonaceous molecules. But they're going to be made at a very low abundance level. So I've written in the past that as we've studied these interstellar molecular clouds, we've not found any ribose, we've not found any amino acids, we've not found any nucleobases. These are the simplest building blocks of life molecules, but I'm predicting we will find them in the relatively near future. You're not going to find them at a part per million, but we should be able to find them at a few parts per billion. And now we've got the technology to make discoveries at those abundance levels. And so what we see in the upper clouds of Venus is evidence for that. Now that we can make detections at a part per billion, they found phosphine at 40 parts per billion. And when they say in the article that these things cannot be made abiotically, they can be made abiotically at very low abundance levels. If you want to get a high concentration, yeah, I would agree. The only way you're going to get a high concentration if they're the residue of the remains of life. But at low abundance levels, we're going to find those. On the other hand, I think we're going to find, for example, the simple amino acids, even at one part per billion, we're not going to find tryptophan. We're not going to find any of the basic amino acids. Again, our understanding of the chemistry is that, yes, there is chemistry that can make those things, but it's going to be an abundance level way, way below tryptophan. In fact, some biochemists that I've read said it's not going to be found at any abundance level unless it comes from life. But yeah, you can find that article at reasons.org. Just search for upper clouds of Venus, it'll pop right up.
We've got 3 minutes left until noon. Time for one more question. This one is from Yuvan in the Netherlands. He says, since Adam was created from the dust of the ground, could this be the reason that we humans host more microbes, especially in our gut, than our own cells?
Well, we need all those microbes existing on our skin and in our gut and lots of other places in our human body in order to be able to thrive. And that's kind of the miracle. I mean, Yuvan's a biologist. He can tell you that we got about 10 times as many microbes existing on our bodies as we have human cells, but they're all necessary. And all of that comes from the dust of the earth. I mean, Carl Sagan always made the comment, we're all made out of stardust. You know, the elements that stars manufacture and the molecules that they produce, that's the building blocks of all life forms. So in one sense, you can say, all of us come from the dust, all of us return to the dust. I mean, we celebrate a Christian funeral, as they say, we came from the dust, we're going to return to the dust. And so, yeah, 100% of your human body, you can find all the chemicals, molecules in the dust of the earth. So, okay, with that, I'm going to pop up again the URL for the meeting. So let me go into screen share again. And we'll pop this up. So we didn't get to, there you go. That's the URL you're gonna need to go into the meeting. And once, I'm gonna wait a little bit till we get a number of you in the meeting. So, but yeah, once you're in, you'll be able to engage one another with video and audio. And then once we get up to what I think is close to a maximum number, I'll break us up into small groups so that we can engage one another, fellowship with one another, but also spend some time with the study question. What do you think about all these different purposes for God creating the universe? How do you think they fit in? And in particular, as believers, as one, I've been talking about this in the context of unbelievers, but as believers, appreciating these multiple purposes, how should that affect the way we live? How should that affect the way we engage one another? So I'll give you a few more seconds to leave up this slide. And once that happens, I'll close out this webinar and I'll go into our reasons.org site and open up the meeting where we can all gather together. And yeah, that'll go on until 12:30. And then I'll shut that down too. And again, this will be stable for at least 6 more weeks. Okay, I'm going to stop this. And I'll end the webinar.